Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Friday, the 31st of March. A day after Donald Trump became the first US president to be indicted on criminal charges, we ask our correspondent in New York when he'll appear in court. The Ukrainian president Volodymyr Zelensky visits Bucha 1 year after its liberation from a brutal Russian occupation. And the South African Paralympian Oscar Pistorius is denied parole for murdering Reeva Steenkamp. Also in the podcast... No, not bubble wrap being popped. That is the sound of a plant crying. As he makes another run for the White House, Donald Trump is facing 4 criminal investigations, including 2 linked to his attempts to overturn his 2020 election defeat. But it's arguably the least serious of those 4 cases that has landed him the dubious distinction of becoming the first US president, sitting or former, to face criminal charges. As you may have heard in our previous edition, Mr. Trump was indicted by a grand jury in New York on Thursday following an inquiry into a hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels. Inevitably, the news of the indictment has prompted contrasting reactions from his supporters and his critics.
It shows that somebody can't just be in that office of the presidency and get away with murder and death and destruction, as Trump calls for. Literally. I had complete faith that Trump will be brought to some form of justice and have to answer and be accountable.
What's happened is an outrage. An indictment against Donald Trump for an event that occurred 7-8 years ago in an agreement between 2 adults? Why? What for? They don't want the man to even make it to election day because they're afraid he's going to win with a landslide, and I believe he will.
Donald Trump himself has said he is completely innocent and reportedly wants to be hauled into court in handcuffs in order to turn it into a spectacle. So when is he likely to appear in court? I spoke to our correspondent Neda Taufik in New York on Friday morning.
Well, after a late night of conversations with the district attorney's office, Mr. Trump's lawyers say he is expected to surrender on Tuesday of next week. So things moving at pace where Mr. Trump in Florida and Mar-a-Lago would likely fly to New York on Monday. And then he would appear here where I am, first at the district attorney's office to be fingerprinted, have his mugshot taken like any other defendant, though, of course, he is a former president. So throughout all of that, he will be escorted by his Secret Service detail. Mr. Trump's lawyers say he will not be placed in handcuffs. And then he will be in front of a judge in court to hear the charges formally against him and to enter his plea. Now, of course, it will be a stunning scene. And already we have the world's media really descending here on Lower Manhattan to capture every moment of it.
Now, I said it was arguably the least serious of the cases he's facing, but we don't actually know what's in these charges. It could be a misdemeanor with just a fine or something much more serious.
That's exactly right. And the indictment will remain under seal. Those charges will remain under seal until the first court appearance by Mr. Trump. So it is a few days yet until we know what exactly is in there. But we are already hearing reports in U.S. media that it includes more than 30 counts of falsifying business records. Now, as you mentioned, perhaps a misdemeanor, but we are hearing that prosecutors are going to seek felony charges as well, arguing that those falsifying of business records was meant to conceal a crime, an election finance crime. Now, that is a legal theory that has been untested so far. And we know from the past attempts by prosecutors to hold politicians accountable for blurring the line between their personal finances and campaign contributions has proved to be tricky. So this is a case that will have a very large spotlight on it, not least because Mr. Trump is also, for now, the front runner for Republicans in 2024.
Neda Taufik in New York. The death of the South African model Reeva Steenkamp on Valentine's Day 10 years ago made headlines around the world. She'd been shot dead by her boyfriend, the former Paralympian Oscar Pistorius. He claimed he thought he was firing at an intruder, but was eventually convicted of her murder. As we record this podcast, a parole board in South Africa has denied him an early end to his 13-year sentence. Our correspondent Andrew Harding in Pretoria has more.
I'm afraid it's a pretty farcical situation, the South African justice system looking like it's made a big mess of this. In fact, today's parole board hearing, we're now learning, should never have gone ahead in the first place. That's because the prison authorities here actually received a letter 3 days ago, on Tuesday of this week, explaining to them that Oscar Pistorius has not actually served, according to their calculations, half his time in prison, half of his sentence. In fact, that time will come next August in 2024. Now, I spoke just a short while ago to Oscar Pistorius, his uncle Arnold, who was mystified, who said it was clear to him that he had served half his sentence, and he said he would be getting legal advice on how this confusion could have arisen. What seems to have happened, though, is that because Pistorius was initially sentenced once, that was appealed, he was sentenced again, he spent some time in prison, he spent some time under house arrest, then he spent another longer period, which he's currently still doing, in prison. There's confusion about exactly when his sentence should be considered to have started. And it seems like the Supreme Court of Appeal here and the Chief Justice have decided it only began on the last time he began his prison sentence. So they're taking the strictest interpretation of the law, if you like.
Andrew, that, as you said right at the beginning there, is not a situation that covers the justice system there with much glory. Can we get to the substance of the issue as opposed to the justice system, but I suppose the family of Reeva Steenkamp and the reaction there?
Well, they've said they welcome this delay. They argued in the parole board, in the prison here behind me where Pistorius is still incarcerated. They argued today that they didn't believe that he was genuine in his remorse. They still insist that Oscar Pistorius needs to confess to killing Reeva Steenkamp, his girlfriend, deliberately. A court has never ruled on that. It simply ruled that Pistorius should have known that whoever was hiding behind his bathroom door would die when he shot 3 times through that closed door. But the Pistorius family insists that Pistorius has not shown remorse, has not admitted the truth, and therefore should stay in prison. But we also know that Pistorius and his lawyers argued that he has shown remorse. He's met Reeva Steenkamp's father last year and expressed his remorse again and apologised for his actions. We also know that prison officials and social workers have spoken about his behaviour during the last years in prison, and leaked information from a previous court dispute seems to indicate that prison officials believe that Pistorius in general has behaved well and that in their view he's ticked the right boxes to be allowed out on parole. But clearly that's not going to happen, at least for some time, as more clarity no doubt is sought and more lawyers get involved in trying to work out where and when Pistorius could be eligible for parole.
Andrew Harding in Pretoria. The actress Gwyneth Paltrow has been awarded a symbolic sum of $1 after winning a 2-week court battle over a skiing incident in 2016. She'd been sued by 76-year-old retiree Terry Sanderson, who accused the Hollywood star of crashing into him at a resort in the US state of Utah. From there, our correspondent Sophie Long has this report.
The Oscar-winning actress has been present throughout this trial that's been streamed around the world like a reality TV courtroom drama.
This is hard because I don't like going through this scene.
He said he broke 4 ribs and has permanent brain damage. But she said she suffered too.
He has deterred you from enjoying the rest of what was a very expensive vacation.
Well, I lost half a day of skiing.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
He said he was hit from behind.
I heard something I've never heard at a ski resort, and that was a blood-curdling scream. Just, I can't do it. It was, and then, boom.
But she gave a different version of the collision.
I was skiing and 2 skis came between my skis, forcing my legs apart. And then there was a body pressing against me and there was a very strange grunting noise. So my brain was trying to make sense of what was happening. I thought, is this a practical joke? Is someone like doing something perverted? This is really, really strange.
May I ask how tall you are?
I'm just under 5'10". 10.
With some of Ms. Paltrow's testimony as left field as her lifestyle tips, the trial became an unexpected social media circus. With every day and every outfit, people around the world devoured the details. And late-night hosts turned the case into comedy.
He's a bumbling optometrist. She's a celebrity mogul. They collide on a ski mountain, and neither one can remember what happened. This Christmas, see Hallmark's newest hit, Goopsie Daisy, a ski accident of the heart.
Thank you.
But no one was laughing here.
For the record,
Mr. Sanderson's lawyers tried to paint a picture of an entitled celebrity lacking in care for the little people. And Ms. Paltrow's legal team said he wanted to hold her accountable for the unwanted effects of aging and exploit her high profile and wealth. After a trial lasting nearly 2 weeks, it took the jury just 2 hours to decide that it was not Ms. Paltrow, but Mr. Sanderson who had been responsible for the crash. As the actress and influencer left court, she went to see the man whose accusations had brought her here and said, "I wish you well."
Sophie Long, reporting from Utah. It's claimed that plants respond well to being talked to, but now it seems they can sort of talk back. Well, that is the sound made by a grapevine in response to being cut. A new study from Israeli researchers published in the scientific journal Cell reveals details of sounds made by different plants when put under stress. And they're louder than you might think. David Lewis has the details.
It's a major scientific breakthrough that could well have a huge impact on how we farm in the future. Researchers at Tel Aviv University recorded ultrasonic plant sounds inside a soundproof chamber and a greenhouse, and they provoked the plants. Not watering them and cutting stems produced an audible response, similar to popcorn bursting and the popping of bubble wrap. And fascinatingly, different flora let out different calls. Here's what emaciated wheat sounds like. And this, of course, is a tomato plant that hasn't received enough water. The researchers suspect the popping noise is a byproduct of cavitation, when tiny bubbles burst and produce mini shockwaves inside the plant's vascular system. Plants clicked much more when they were under stress. Interestingly, scientists found the sounds were emitted at a volume similar to that of human speech. But if you think you can lean down and listen in, you'll be sadly disappointed. For the study, specialist microphones recorded frequencies of up to 250 kilohertz. Florists, gardeners and ramblers can only hear up to 16 kilohertz. The plant's high-pitched frequencies have been lowered so we can all hear them. But while humans can't hear this unhappiness in the undergrowth, there's animals out there who can. Researchers believe bats, mice and insects can probably recognise the noises being made. Professor Lila Khadani, who co-authored the study, said the data could help farmers going forward. We believe that humans can utilise this information given the right tools, such as sensors that tell growers when plants need watering. Apparently, an idyllic field of flowers can be rather a noisy place, she wrote.
David Lewis reporting. And still to come on the podcast.
Those snatched moments, the 20 minutes when you're waiting at the luggage carousel. You used to have to do nothing but go into your thoughts. Now we all take out our phone. We've been deprived of a signal for a couple of hours in an airplane. And maybe we don't have quite as rich an inner life.
We hear from the acclaimed writer Ian McEwan.
Abnormal transactions.
Some kind of cyber attack on a bank.
Tens of millions of dollars.
Something I don't think anybody has seen before.
It's a cyber criminal group.
From the BBC World Service.
The Lazarus Heist is back for season 2.
It was really like in the movies.
Find out more at the end of this podcast.
Until February last year, Bucha was known as a quiet, family-friendly suburb of the Ukrainian capital Kyiv. But then the Russian invaders arrived, and it became infamous for the atrocities they committed against civilians. Ukraine says at least 461 people were murdered there. It is now a year since Russian troops fled the area, and the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has marked the moment by visiting Bucha and handing out medals to those who helped liberate it. President Zelensky, who was accompanied by European leaders from Croatia, Slovakia, Slovenia and Moldova, promised to punish the Russians over their war crimes and said Ukraine would ultimately triumph.
The battle for the foundation of the free world is taking place on Ukrainian soil. We will definitely win. Russian evil will fall right here in Ukraine and will not be able to rise again.
Our correspondent Hugo Bechega in Bucha told me about life there under the brief but horrific Russian occupation. And a warning, his interview contained some disturbing details.
Bucha is one of those cities that will forever be remembered as the site of some of the worst atrocities committed by Russian forces here in Ukraine. I went to Yablunska Street earlier today, and this is the street where bodies of civilians were left in the open. Those images shocked all of us. People who were trying to see a relative were trying to flee and were executed. And also there were the rape allegations, the torture chamber. So almost everyone here witnessed the brutality of the occupation. And I've been talking to Lydia, who witnessed some of the crimes committed by Russian soldiers.
I passed by the house and I heard screams and the sound of gunshots. They created a torture chamber in that house. A man who tried to escape was shot. A friend of my son was carrying food for his parents. He was caught by the Russians. They gouged his eyes out. His ears and nose were cut off. He was later found dead with his hands tied.
Lydia, describing what happened in Bucha in the early days of the invasion, and what of efforts to find justice for the victims of those crimes?
There is a massive effort to collect evidence of possible war crimes, to interview people like Lydia, who saw those alleged crimes. And international experts, human rights activists, volunteers are working here, not only in Bucha, but across Ukraine to collect this evidence. Because President Zelensky has been saying that any kind of resolution to this conflict needs to involve the creation of a special tribunal to prosecute those people who are accused of committing crimes here in Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, a year after the Russians left, just describe for us how Bucha looks today.
In the main parts of the city where the Russians had their bases, where we've seen those atrocities being committed, there's been a massive international effort to rebuild the city. But you still see signs of the occupation, bullet holes in some walls and doors and, some houses that have been partially destroyed. And if you talk to residents, all of them have memories of life under occupation here. And what is interesting is that when I was talking to Lydia, he said, well, look, yes, today we're here marking this occasion 1 year after the city was liberated. But remember that millions of people are still under Russian occupation in other parts of the country. So perhaps the war is over here, but the war itself is far from over.
Hugo Bechega talking to me from the Ukrainian town of Bucha. As we record this podcast, at least 35 people are confirmed to have died in the Indian city of Indore after the floor of a Hindu temple caved in on Thursday. Worshippers had been praying when a platform covering a well collapsed. I heard more about what went wrong from our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan.
Yesterday was one of the biggest Hindu festivals called Ram Navami. And during this festival, hundreds of people go to various temples across the country to pray and then to offer, and they have celebrations. And in this particular temple in Madhya Pradesh state, in central India, in Indore city, people are standing on the platform of a big well. And then this is a sidestep well. People usually go down to take water. This water is also used for temple as well as regarded as holy. And because there was overcrowding, the grill and a bit of a concrete on top of the well just caved in, plunging dozens of people into the well, deep as 8 meters. So, unfortunately, a number of people, men, women, children, died. The rescue efforts were going on, but then it created a lot of panic also. And now the government says that, you know, they almost completed the operation. They believe maybe one or two people may be still stuck. And they've rescued a lot of injured people. And they've been admitted to hospital. And they're now investigating how this happened and whether they could have avoided this.
Yeah, I mean, this must raise questions about safety at other temples and other places where there's platforms over wells.
It's not only about platform over wells. We're talking about thousands, tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands, the Hindu religious festivals in India. So what is lacking here is crowd control. The temple authority sometimes might expect 500 people. Then suddenly you will see 5,000 people. So they will struggle to manage how so many people are coming in. And people would want to, you know, get the view or the blessings of the Lord, you know, first. And they want to go back home early. And also the lack of security forces, they can't be deployed everywhere because, you know, there may be like 100 temples in a district. How many police officers you can deploy to, you know, each temple? And many of these temples, some of them have, you know, very old infrastructure like the one concrete. So this is what, like, the security audit should be done in many of the temples and installations. And that is what the government is suggesting now.
Our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasaneta Rajan. Many of us who live in big cities spend large portions of our days stuck in traffic or crammed onto buses or trains, battling our way to work, the shops and back home again. There's a project, though, that argues this is unnecessary and that urban centres can be redesigned to prioritise shorter journeys. These so-called 15-minute cities would help reduce car use and pollution and make our lives more convenient. But they have been a lightning rod for conspiracy theorists who say they are an attempt to imprison people in their neighbourhoods. Anna Holligan in the Netherlands has been investigating.
For advocates, the idea sounds pretty pragmatic. Put everything we need from doctors and supermarkets to jobs and schools within easy reach by foot or bicycle. But type the term 15-minute city into TikTok and it generates hundreds of videos using familiar hashtags Agenda 2030, World Economic Forum, to suggest the 50-minute goal is part of a sinister global plot to limit our freedoms by enforcing climate lockdowns.
This one is full-on conspiracy.
What do they say?
The power has always been with us. We just had to find our voice. Say no to 15-minute cities.
Rijke Kuipers, a Dutch disinformation reporter, has been tracking the spread and evolution of this conspiracy.
The 2030 conspiracy theory is about this global agenda where world leaders met up and are supposed to have discussed how to use these environmental concerns to impose almost authoritarian restrictions on the people.
And a 15-minute city is evidence of that plan being put into action.
Yeah, and it's a form of confirmation bias as well.
15-minute city prisons. That's what they're calling them, 15-minute city prisons. Yeah. This misinterpretation has roots in the UK, where two separate proposals in Oxford, one for low-traffic neighbourhoods and another to create 15-minute cities, both partly designed to cut carbon emissions, were blended and drizzled with disinformation.
You in your area will only be allowed within that 15-minute zone that you've
been allocated. Videos like this one have been getting hundreds of thousands of views, but the content doesn't always tally with reality. And there's evidence here in the Netherlands where pretty much the entire country is already made up of 15-minute cities. Despite the people objecting to the 15-minute idea, saying in order to get this, we'll be forced to sacrifice our freedom of movement, there's no sign of any boundaries or restrictions here. And it's not the intention either. According to Professor Carlos Moreno, a city planner credited with creating the 15-minute concept. I caught up with him while he was in Asia, advising cities how to adopt the 15-minute principles.
This is just a concept for improving the quality of life. We need to change our urban lifestyle. It's not a traffic plan.
Just need to interrogate this a bit because there are some concerns about a social segregation.
We propose to mix people, the high revenue with the low revenue, with the middle revenue.
There will be people listening to you thinking that this sounds like social engineering.
No, this is not a question of social engineering. This is a question of fight against climate change for having a less energy dependency.
Public polarization over the 50-minute city has highlighted climate disinformation as a new front line for cities seeking innovative solutions to pressing environmental challenges that won't disappear.
Anna Holligan in the Netherlands. Now a quick word about this weekend's Happy Pod with Andrew Peach.
Yes, I've been talking to the people at the heart of the world's happiest news stories this week. So imagine you're out with a metal detector, wondering what you can find. What you find is a rock which contains $170,000 worth of gold. We've got that story from Australia for you. In China, if you fancy taking your dog for a walk in your lunch break, but you don't have time to go and collect your dog from home, there's now a taxi service that means you can meet your dog in the park. And scientists in Sweden have been looking into the secret messages contained in our sweat and how they can make us happier. Those stories, plus listeners in the Philippines, Spain, Italy and New Zealand, in the Happy Pod in this podcast feed on Saturday.
Andy, thank you. Finally, Ian McEwan is often called one of Britain's greatest living writers, author of books like Atonement or On Chesil Beach. Now the Booker Prize winner is performing a rare reading of his work accompanied by the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Nicola Stanbridge spoke to him about the concert being staged at the Barbican here in London on Friday night and broadcast later on Radio 3.
Back from touring his latest book, Lessons, Ian McEwan is glued once more to his writing desk. At 74, he's been assessing just over half a century's work for this BBC Symphony Orchestra concert, which will begin with the Polish composer Grażyna Bacewicz.
Running music and words together is always a strange matter. There's something very specific about language. We speak often of its ambiguity, but I think its concision, precision, is even more extraordinary. We can transfer thoughts from vibrating a little air around us. We can transfer thoughts from one mind to another. You can forget about telepathy. About music, there is something so rich in human meaning. It's like to adapt the wonderful lines of Philip Larkin from his poem, The Trees. The trees are coming into leaf like something almost being said. That is the condition of music.
The BBC Symphony Orchestra will play Grieg's Holberg Suite for your reading of Saturday, set as an anti-war demonstration takes place against the invasion of Iraq. What are your thoughts 20 years on?
It was a monstrous foreign policy disaster, and the chaos that's ensued in Iraq lives on. It's had massive effects on the way governments behave since, especially the line that Obama drew in the sand over Syria, but did not actually follow through. And we continue to rue the day that the invasion ever took place.
For your reading of Enduring Love, the BBC Symphony Orchestra will play Arvo Pärt, Cantus in Memory of Benjamin Britten. You mention you've been writing for nearly 50 years. Would you rewrite any of your early work to accommodate modern sensibilities? Would you be happy, for instance, for future rewrites of your work, as we've seen with Roald Dahl and Ian Fleming?
No, I wouldn't. W.H. Auden rewrote massively his work, and it had to be rescued for us by good scholars. Except that you write from your times, the times might change, but it has to be read through the prism of history. So no, I don't approve of rewriting of Roald Dahl or anyone else. I hope that my literary executors and literary agents will stay true to the word that I wrote. I would peer down or up from wherever I end up, probably in total oblivion, being very cross about it if people started tampering with what I wrote.
You've said the world didn't seem so crowded, noisy and intrusive when you started writing.
I do regret the passing of what I regard as one of the great luxuries of civilization, and that is solitude. I think those snatched moments, the 20 minutes when you're waiting at the luggage carousel, you used to have to do nothing but go into your thoughts. Now we all take out our phone, we've been deprived of a signal for a couple of hours in an airplane, and maybe we don't have quite as rich an inner life. If you get in the habit of solitude, and which is an entirely different thing, by the way, from loneliness. Treat your mind as a garden that you can walk around in. I think generally it leads to more happiness.
Ian McEwan talking to Nicola Stanbridge. The concert will be broadcast on Radio 3 here in the UK on Sunday, May the 14th. And you can also listen to it on the BBC Sounds app. That is it for now from the Global News podcast, but we'll be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Stephen Bailey and produced by Rebecca Wood. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Cyber attack, army payments.
A series of increasingly sophisticated cybercrimes being carefully orchestrated around the world.
The attraction to target ATMs is fairly obvious. I mean, they're full of cash.
It was just like abracadabra. Put these cards, put any PIN number, and you get money.
Jackpot.
US investigators say the heists are being carried out by the Lazarus Group, a criminal hacking gang who are said to be working under the orders of the North Korean state.
Tens of millions of dollars for the North Koreans.
These actors are not as anonymous as they think they are.
The group's goal? To steal money to help fund the country's growing ballistic missile and nuclear program.
But despite evidence suggesting otherwise, North Korea denies any involvement.
In season two of The Lazarus Heist, from the BBC World Service, we're following the latest twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
And piles of stolen cash.
Over $2 billion. We're at $2.1 billion in stolen funds.
Search for The Lazarus Heist, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.